Hello, everybody. This is Eva Herr, and welcome to the Healing of Agape this week. This week, I'm honored to have with us Marilyn Schlitt from Noetic Sciences. Hello, Marilyn. How are you?
Hey, thank you. I'm here, and I'm happy.
Good. You've got a new book out, don't you, Marilyn, Consciousness and Healing?
We do. We have a new book. It's on integral medicine, integral approaches to mind-body medicine, and it's a collection of essays. We have 66 contributors, so it's taking an integral kind of philosophy and applying it to the field of healthcare.
Well, I have to tell you, I've read the thing, and I think it's a wonderful book.
Great. Thank you.
Everybody should pick up a copy, as well as the CD in the back of it, by the way.
That's right. It's a DVD, so they get a bonus free movie, a 50-minute movie at the end of the book. That's right.
That's right. That was great. I loved it. So tell us about your work. Well, first of all, tell us a little bit about who you are.
Well, let's see, who am I right now? I am Vice President for Research and Education at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and I'm also a senior scientist at California Pacific Medical Center. I'm somebody who is, you know, passionately interested in understanding the potentials of consciousness to help correct some of the deep problems that we face as a civilization today. I think that the sort of causal model that we're operating out of is the idea that the source of most of the problems we face as a civilization are based in our own worldview and our own consciousness. And so how do we begin to shift the way in which we perceive reality such that we can begin to solve some of the problems that we've created? And it's that Einstein quote about we won't be able to solve the problems from the frame of reference from which they were created. So how do we understand more about the nature of consciousness, our subjectivity, our awareness, and how do we then use that in such a way that we can address some of our current challenges? And medicine is one of those areas. We see that so much has progressed in terms of our mastery of technology and the kind of environment that we see in terms of, you know, genetic engineering and biotech. How do we begin to recognize that those aspects are fundamentally important and vital to the future of medicine and not complete? And what we're losing is the intimacy, the relationship, that sense of connection. And I think that we're also losing the ability to nurture the health professionals themselves, so that when we look at the crisis that we're facing in healthcare today, we can see that a great deal of it is correctable. So that's what this book is about. That's what my work is about. I'm also very much interested in doing, you know, research from a variety of perspectives, basic science and clinical studies, and I'd be happy to talk about that too.
Well, I'll tell you what, the one comment that I have, and then I have two things that I've thought of I want to ask you, is I wonder, have we not lost it, but not have we just not yet found it?
I think a lot of this is, you know, we talk about the new age. I think a lot of it is old age wisdom. It comes from thousands of years of people understanding and developing healing systems and healthcare systems that that were really much more about promoting healing than treating disease. So how can we begin to rediscover some of these principles? And then I think what you said is right. There are new things to be discovered still. And one of the things that makes me excited about, you know, this time in human history is that never before have so many worldviews, belief systems, you know, ways of engaging reality come into contact. And in that point of convergence, there is the possibility of breakthrough. So as we have the old wisdoms coming from, you know, Tibet and China, India, the Amazon, all over the world where we had indigenous wisdoms coming into contact with the best of Western science and technology, you know, there's tension points, there's ways in which conflict occurs, but there's also the possibility that something generative can be birthed out of that interface. And so I agree with you. I think that maybe a big part of what we need to discover is still ahead of us, but I think it may be that it's about reconciling what is behind us with what we know today in order to craft something for the future.
I totally agree with you. You know, one of the first things that you said in your book was a physician can harm a patient with what he knows, but even more so with what he doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
How on earth do we to listen that vibration, that, you know, that we are electromagnetic fields, that consciousness does exist and that intent is real. How do you convince someone to listen to you when you're trying to explain this to a typical Western medicine physician?
Well, I mean, I think that data and reason are important tools. I think that also touching people at the level of their own experience is really important. So, you know, we have been very concerned at the Institute of Noetic Sciences and at California Pacific Medical Center with an evidence-based approach. You know, how do we really document, how do we bring the best of science to some of these questions about the powers of intention, the relationship of mind and body, the potentials that come from spiritual practice or engagement in nature. All of these issues are important at the sort of intuitive and experiential level, and it's also important that we bring discernment, and science provides a lens in which to calibrate some of the claims that are made today. So one of the things, you know, this integral model that we're talking about in the book, Consciousness and Healing, by integral, what we're referring to is a model that holds the whole. You know, it is a holistic approach, but it's going deeply into the interface between personal experience. I mean, when you're ill or when you have some kind of, you know, disease state, a state of unwellness, that's a profoundly experiential first-person kind of perspective. You know, people use the I statement, I don't feel well today. So that part, that domain, is often left out of the medical intervention in lieu of then what is the third-person perspective, the it, the science. So we've objectified a lot of what is our personal experience. And that's not all bad, but it's also not complete. This integral model then honors, you know, that first-person perspective as well as the third-person scientific, and then brings it together within what we call kind of the intersubjective, that sense of our being in relationship with one another. So the sense that culture, we're embedded in our own culture, and different people grow up in different cultural settings that shape the framework in which they view reality. That's important. And then we also have to deal with the structural issues, the socioeconomic, political issues that shape what medicine is evolving into and what it's come from. So this integral model is really about honoring a multiplicity of perspectives, with the idea that each of those perspectives has something to offer when we consider the nature of a new model for medicine.
I'm curious, most people that become enlightened have had either a near-death experience or a really bad dark night of the soul. What woke you up to consciousness?
Oh, wow.
Was there a specific thing?
We do a whole research project here on transformational practices and have interviewed, you know, 50 masters from different traditions, talking to them about what facilitates transformation and that kind of change in worldview. I would not be so bold as to say I've reached an enlightened state. I still have many steps to learn, but I think my interest in consciousness came, I grew up in Detroit in, you know, the 60s and 70s, and it was a time of great turmoil. And I was aware that there was the idea of a paradigm shift or a worldview shift. Thomas Kuhn's book, The Structure of Scientific Revolution, had just come out. And I was really intrigued by the idea that our model of reality, that thing we hold to be most true, changes and has changed. Even within the scientific framework, you know, we see that there have been radical shifts in what we perceive to be truth. I found that a really liberating concept. And then the next step for me after that was when I was studying with a neurophysiologist at Wayne State Medical School, and he gave me a book one day called Psychic Exploration by the Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell. And that book literally changed my life. It was the idea that psychic phenomena are subject to scientific interest, and that, in fact, this may be the next paradigm shift in terms of understanding, you know, causality, understanding reality. And that really, really captured my imagination. So that was in 1977. And, you know, it just started me on an odyssey of working in various research centers across the world. And
it becomes, you know, an obsession, doesn't it?
Well, it becomes,
it
with the bliss,
me.
D- Joseph Campbell says, follow your bliss. And it became for me some really big, a big principle that guided how I then lived out my life for the next 30 years. Anyway, we've been playing this. So I'm really interested in how science and spirituality come together. What does that interface look like? What do we have to learn about ourselves and our place in reality from that interface? And then from about 1980 on, I've been interested in how that question of the science-spirituality interface translates through the lens of medicine or healthcare. I became a medical anthropologist and got a PhD from the University of Texas at Austin, really looking at how different cultures model health, how they hold the body, how do we define what is the body, and different traditions hold that differently. You know, in our culture, we're very much based on a physicalist perspective, you know, so if you can't taste it or touch it or measure it, it's not real.
Right.
But many other traditions hold a whole spectrum of different positions on that. So the body can become a metaphysical construct as well as a biological construct. And that's interesting, and I think that that has something important to tell us about how we can, you know, understand medicine from different perspectives. So that's, you know, I became interested in consciousness because it was a way of studying worldview, of recognizing that I think we are co-creators of what is the possible future. And if we can own that, own our responsibility and our power, really, to help formulate better questions and to then articulate better answers, I think that then we can apply consciousness in ways that can be very helpful.
Elliot Dasher, in his section there, talked about causality and ascension being upward and downward. And one thing I wanted to ask you, do you think there is a connection with horizontal energy lines and cohesion as far as when your consciousness is raised, the more cohesive your field, then the more focused you and the more understanding you will have of that consciousness. Would that make any sense?
It's interesting. It's a model, and it would be potentially a testable model. I think Elliot was talking about sort of the mind-body connection, the idea of, you know, the body influencing the mind influencing the body, so upward and downward causation. And I think that what you're suggesting I like very much, the idea that we can and are clearly embedded in fields. You know, the electromagnetic fields that surround us all the time are real. And the, I think, question is, do they act as a medium by which information is communicated from one place to another? And can your field and my field come into some kind of coherent state such that we are in a resonance with one
mm-hmm.
another? People do talk about that kind of thing. Sorry, I can't have somebody come in here.
That's okay.
So they talk a lot in subtle energy research about this notion that people can get into some kind of resonance with one another. There is certainly a widespread belief in these ideas. We know, for example, that two people who sit together can show changes in their heart rate and their heart rate variability as a result of being in proximity with each other. So our hearts begin to beat together because we're part of an electromagnetic field.
Right.
The question is, do these fields extend beyond what we understand in terms of the, you know, the current understanding of electromagnetics? Do they interact with things like the quantum world, such that, you know, my state of mind or my state of consciousness can have some impact on another person, even if they're at a distance?
Mm-hmm.
These are empirical questions that I think have pretty profound implications for, you know, how we model reality, how we model what is true. If in fact my well-being is directly connected to your well-being, then we can begin to see a nested set of relationships between us. One of the things we advance in this book, Consciousness and Healing, is a relational model. I think this integral model is profoundly relational. And I think it's relational at the sense of the mind-body, recognizing there's a relationship between our thoughts, our emotions, our stresses, our interpretation of our stresses and our biology. So there's that relationship. There's the relationship between us. And, for example, Dean Ornish talks about the fact, and he has a chapter in our book, Consciousness and Healing, where one of the major predictors of health is not, you know, diet and exercise and the things that he's known for, but he argues that it's really healthy relationships. It's about the fact that you can see men, for example, live longer and are healthier on average if they're in a healthy relationship, if they're married and in a healthy, happy relationship. So there's something very profound about intimacy. One of the things they're seeing today is that women seem to have some insulating capacities that protect them from disease, and it has to do with intimacy. It has to do with girlfriend energy, that we have somebody that we can confide in and tell our deepest truths to allows us a sense of healing, and it seems to then have biological implications. So there's that set of relationships. There's our sense of relationship to the environment, and we often find ourselves fundamentally disconnected from the natural world. And again, how can we begin to see that healing is not only just about our mind-body or about our role as, you know, people, but what we're doing to our environment actually changes how we function as biological citizens. Michael Lerner, who also writes a chapter in our book, he talks about how one of the most toxic environments on the planet is mother's breast milk, because it becomes the repository of all the toxins that we've taken in. And one of the principal culprits of environmental toxicity are hospitals that are incinerating the plastics and the chemicals that are then pumped into the upper atmosphere and that rain down on us and then create this source of contamination that you find in the breast milk. It's a full system kind of thinking that requires a consciousness shift in order to begin to see that we are fundamentally interconnected with the environment. And then there'd be one more step I take, which is the spiritual, or that sense of something larger than ourselves, larger than our place in the physical world, but a sense of our well-being in proximity to, you know, a greater sense of meaning and purpose. So whether we call that spirituality or metaphysics or whatever the language is that people want to put on that, again, there is science that speaks to the idea that holding a sense of meaning and purpose is health promoting. Participation in a religious or spiritual community is health promoting. And in fact, the epidemiological data, the public health data, is unequivocal today in showing that people who participate in some kind of religious or spiritual practice are on average healthier than people who don't. So there are ways in which, you know, we can use science to translate what we know intuitively from this old age knowledge to begin to craft something for the future that I think is very helpful in understanding both the system approach, the whole system relational approach, as well as what is the possibility of a whole new model for medicine.
You have a chapter in your book by Candace Pert talking about neurotransmitters and emotions and how they manifest health. What do you think first signals those neurotransmitters to start firing, or do you know yet?
Well, I'm not a neuroendocrinologist like Candace Pert, but what she argues based on a survey of the literature and what, you know, fits within the whole area of psychoneuroimmunology and psychoneuroendocrinology is the connection between our emotions and our biology. And so she talks about these neurotransmitters. She talks about peptides as the carriers of emotion, and that through emotion, then we are able to lead to a whole cascade of biological responses that inform whether we're healthy or diseased. So we see, for example, that sadness, depression, has a very profound effect on the immune system. So if somebody is in a state of emotional disorder or discomfort, that actually has measurable changes in their biology. Well, a bigger question, and one that is up now for people, is can positive emotions have a beneficial effect on our immune system? So staying happy, staying in a life-supporting state of consciousness may actually have beneficial effects on our health and well-being. So these are the kind of questions that, you know, scientists are really interested in looking at the mechanism of action and understanding then how it is that there could be a connection between, you know, neurons firing in the brain and, you know, a sense of trepidation in our belly with then our immune system or our endocrine system. And I think these are really important and interesting questions.
If there was a way to predict the onset of illness before it happened, and it was provable, how receptive do you think scientists would be?
Well, again, you know, this integral model requires that we be realistic about the socioeconomic, political paradigm in which we're operating. And there is a whole set of, you know, I was just meeting with a woman who works with the United Nations and does international programming related to health initiatives. And she was talking about the huge industry related to pharmaceuticals and how when you think about these drugs that are going out into the third world, the people who are the relief agencies are actually having to pay double, if not quadruple, the cost that it would require for generic drugs, for example, because they're linked in with a political economic system and infrastructure that is very difficult to change. So, you know, that's the reality of, you know, what we're working with. And I think that what is needed is a whole system change. We need to really recognize, again, that relationship is fundamental, that, you know, if you look at the healthcare professionals and their level of anxiety and burnout right now, how can we nurture them to nurture themselves, to nurture other people, to then begin to think in a way that gives them enough expansiveness to begin to correct some of these things that we're seeing that are so wrong with the system?
If there was a way to tell if that neurotransmitters were firing and that disease was manifesting long before it manifested in the physical body, do you think they would be receptive?
Right, I didn't answer that question, did I? I think that there are interests at the National Institutes of Health, for example, in looking at new forms of diagnostic tools. You know, there are a whole lot of different kind of subtle energy devices now that make claims that they can, you know, measure changes in energy fields that then correlate with a state of health or disease. Most of these devices have not been tested. Most of them do not function within the same, you know, cultural cognitive framework that, you know, biomedicine operates out of. So there's resistance. There's definitely resistance in the establishment to new ideas. Certainly within the process of peer review, as grant proposals come through to the government to be funded, you know, the peer reviewers, as open-minded as they want to be, are still operating within the container of their own training and their own assumptions. So there are some challenges there for getting new ideas, whether it be about new diagnostic procedures or new treatment modalities, if they don't fit within the kind of pharmacological or physicalist paradigm, it's a harder sell.
Right, it gets ignored or disbelieved one.
Mm-hmm.
What about, have you ever thought about whether you would be able to detect disease before it manifested by testing amplitude versus time in sequencing of electromagnetic fields?
Well, there certainly are a number of devices. I'm not a device person, but there are a number of devices out now that are looking at changes in electromagnetic fields within the body. That is something that, you know, people are doing. The problem is there haven't been enough studies done to, like, oftentimes what people are using is an intuitive reading of the machines. So the machines become a device that the practitioner uses to support their own intuitive feelings about someone. And I think there's a whole area of intuitive diagnosis that is practiced, is believed in, and which has not been subject to very much research. In fact, almost none. intuitive diagnosis is a whole wide area that is waiting to be researched. So anybody out there who's interested in that. But I think that we do need to be, I worked with a man named Larry Burke, who was a radiologist, radiation oncologist, actually at Duke Medical Center. And he was really interested in improving the predictability of various diagnostic tools. So, for example, x-rays are something that has some predictability or interpretability, but it's not 100% accurate. And he was really interested in seeing if you could enhance the signal or our interpretation of the signal of a conventional diagnostic tool like the x-ray with using intuition. And he, I think at this point has not completed his study. He was looking at this from a research perspective, but I don't think he's ever really moved forward with it. So there's really a lot of room there for people to do more to understand how it is that the body itself, my body as a healer, could be an instrument for understanding changes in another living system. That's a whole area that has not been explored within the biomedical paradigm.
I know. I think it's about ready to explode. It's so dying to be researched.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's pulsing and about to explode, waiting on somebody just to tap into it.
Definitely one of the fastest growing areas of interest. It's whether or not scientists can find the right ways to translate and to bridge between what are often very complex metaphysical systems and then sort of the framework of science. And again, I don't think everything has to be translated by science. I think that one of the advantages of this integral model is that there are different ways of knowing. There are different ways of understanding that knowing. You know, for example, if you look at the first person, the intuitive, that sense of consciousness, I position, and you think about how Tibetan Buddhism has been studying the science of subjectivity for thousands of years. And in that process, they've created methodologies for actually calibrating and refining consciousness. And so they have ideas about replication, just like science has replication. Tibetan Buddhism has replication. It has verification. It has, you know, corroboration. So some of the principles that we hold up to be true in the scientific it paradigm or aspect of the integral model are also true within the context of the first person paradigm. So it's, you know, how do we, you know, hold these various methodologies and how do we find the appropriate uses? And also, how do we find discernment? Because it's often very difficult when somebody's facing a life-threatening illness to navigate through all the alternatives that are out there.
Yes, especially for yourself. It really is hard to do that. What kind of work are you doing at Noetic Sciences?
Well, the Institute of Noetic Sciences is now 33 years old. We were founded by Edgar Mitchell, the same Apollo 14 astronaut who wrote that book that I read in 1977. And Edgar is still with us and very interested in...
Don't you find it ironic, synchronistic, that you ended up there after reading that book?
Yeah, it was a beautiful synchronicity for me, you know, many years later, and I never applied for the job. It found me. so, yeah, there is some sort of life path verification in all of that. But, you know, Edgar was really interested in consciousness at the beginning. That was, you know, he had an epiphany coming back from the moon that really suggested to him that rather than focusing on outer space, that perhaps the greatest breakthroughs would come from a real systematic investigation of inner space. So for the last 33 years, we have been supporting that mission and continue to do so. Our book, Consciousness and Healing, I feel like is a tribute to those 30 years of contribution, as well as it is a roadmap to the next 30 to, you know, 300 years of what medicine could live into. Our publisher, Elsevier Press, which is the largest publisher of medical textbooks in the world, has asked for another volume. So we're intending to do a book on intention. Intention to Heal will be the next book that we're working on right now. And then we're interested in, you know, we have a lot of programs related to health and healing. We're doing a clinical trial right now funded by the National Institutes of Health to look at the effect of prayer and contemplative practice.
Is that the one on glioblastomas?
That's a different project. I'm not actually on that glioblastoma study. That's a study, the glio study is being conducted out of California Pacific Medical Center. It's a study looking at distant healing for the potential impact on brain tumors. That's under the direction of Andrew Frankel at California Pacific Medical Center. There was another clinical trial looking at HIV under the direction of John Aston. Both of those projects were started by Elizabeth Targ. My project is looking at placebo and expectancy effects. So if you know that somebody is praying for you from a distance, does that increase your wound healing capacity? That's what I'm looking at in my current study. I'm very interested right now in doing some research on hypnotherapy and hypnosis and contemplative mind, these states of sort of altered consciousness and beginning to understand better how it is that we can sort of use the plasticity of our consciousness to help increase the healing capacities in our bodies. So that's an interest of mine, and I'm also doing a whole bunch of projects with a team of people here on distant learning programs. So we're creating distant learning for health professionals on a variety of different consciousness-related issues. So we're both interested in the basic science of consciousness. We're interested in the application of it in terms of clinical studies, and we have a project right now looking at transformational practices among homeless people. The director of the homeless shelter here in Petaluma, California, asked us to bring a noetic intervention into the homeless population in a way that could help to ground them and help them to increase their internal capacity such that they can navigate better in the external world. And then we're really interested in translation and how do we get these ideas out into the world. So we have a very active website, noetic.org. We also have a program called Shift in Action, and I have a channel on that, what they're calling channels, and it's a teleseminar kind of program around consciousness and healing. So there's lots of things, and there's resource areas on the IONS website on distant healing, on contemplative mind, consciousness and healing. You know, we're really interested in taking what we've learned and communicating it out so that it has the broadest reach possible.
Mm-hmm. What about living in the moment? Have you done any research on that and how that affects your life and how it can better help you deal with what's going on?
Well, no, we haven't done anything specifically on that, but we've had a strong interest in looking at what we call essential capacities. And so things like gratefulness, love, forgiveness, compassion, intention, how do these various principles and practices help to increase health and well-being? And it's really clear, for example, that you know, having forgiveness, practicing forgiveness, is profoundly health-promoting at a psychological level for the person holding the anger. So how do you begin to cultivate? And these are, there are practices within the different spiritual and religious traditions that help us, that give us tools for understanding how one could begin to forgive the unforgivable. Mm-hmm. And forgiving isn't about, you know, condoning or accepting what the other person did. It's simply about letting go of the charge so that you stop being stressed and it stops negatively impacting your psychology and your biology. Within these different traditions, the compassionate intention, for example, you know, mindfulness training is important to that. And so this idea of living in the moment, being in the moment, when you engage in different kind of contemplative or meditative practices, again, there are tools and techniques that you can use that can help to cultivate these in ourselves. How can you just stop the chatter for 5 minutes or 10 in the course of a day to be truly present? These kind of things, I think there's more interest in exploring. Certainly the mindfulness meditation program that Jon Kabat-Zinn developed has been very widely embraced, and there have been a number of studies now, both basic science and clinical, looking at the health benefits of, you know, a 10-minute mindfulness meditation practice each day can be profoundly helpful in how we navigate through, you know, our busy lives.
For the listeners out there, could you give them a couple of suggestions that you found that will help them do that? Because so many people don't really understand what living in the moment is.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, I think just a person would need to find some place in their town, and I think all over, you know, the United States and certainly all over the world today, there are, you know, meditation centers. So you can go, and there are various kinds of meditation practice, from Vipassana to Zen to, you know, all kinds of different things that people can do. Christian contemplative prayer is another approach. So there are various tools, techniques, practices that people can just, you know, open their phone book and look up meditation, and will probably almost certainly find something near to them that they could go and take a class, or, you know, find a teacher. There's some other principles, I think. You know, I like to think about renewal. How do we renew ourselves, and how can we do it recognizing that we have a very busy life, you know, and we're all busy. I think it's, you know, 100% of us are busy today in ways that we weren't. You know, there's email and snail mail and voicemail, and, you know, it's just faxes coming in and meetings being had and conference calls being scheduled and, you know, racing to pick up your kids. And, you know, there's just so much going on that demands our attention. I don't even have television, so that's not one of mine, but, excuse me just one second here. So I think there's little things we can do that we can practice every day that don't require that we change our whole lives immediately. I think that subtly they change as a result of these kinds of practices. And one is recognizing that stress is something that is in our lives, and what we have control over is how we interpret that. So the way in which we define meaning around stress is very powerful and very personal. So, for example, if I'm busy, I can start a dialogue with myself about, oh, this is so awful, I can't believe I have to do this, I don't want to do this, oh, I don't want to get up for this. Or I can just change my perspective on how I story that. And I can say, yes, wow, look, the sun is shining, it's a gorgeous day, I've got all these opportunities today, I'm just going to do the best I can. You know, that little bit of a consciousness shift, it's very tiny. The tiny little shift in our way of storying has profound implications for our physiology and our psychology, and probably for our sociology, in the sense of how we relate to our loved ones. So that's one thing that we can do that's very simple and easy. I think that there are other things, like remembering to just go for a walk in nature or connect to nature in some way. Go sit in the garden, or, you know, spend some time, you know, in a park where there are trees and grass. There's something very nurturing about stopping long enough to be present with nature. And again, it has very measurable changes on our physiology when we do that. That's independent of the exercise part of it. You know, if you can exercise and get the oxygen pumping in your brain, and, you know, all of those cells in the body become more active because they're feeling replenished, that's an important piece too. Then just these kind of practices we talked about, forgiveness, gratefulness, you know, these are little things we can do that help change our perspective.
Well, that was my next question, forgiveness. For some people, that's not an easy thing to do. Do you have some suggestions?
Well, I think that, you know, first of all, people have to feel enough tension around the issue to want to let go of it. They have to want to let go of whatever the resentment is. Because oftentimes people define their lives. They define their identity based on, you know, a grudge they've been carrying for the last 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's an awareness of how does whatever it is you're holding serve you. And honoring that, you know, that hostility I had toward my brother all those years ago served me in some important way. I'm going to have to go in a couple of minutes here because I have another call scheduled.
Well, let me ask you one more question then. Ken Wilber.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing work with Ken Wilber.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's the greatest mind in the world.
Uh-huh.
What can you tell us about him before you go?
Well, he's one of the greatest minds in the world. I think you said that.
And the work that he's doing.
I think that what he's doing with the Integral Institute and Integral University is just phenomenal, really. He's a big thinker, a big connector of the dots, in a lot of different ways. He has stimulated and inspired people all over in many different domains, from education to healthcare to politics to art, to think about this kind of integral philosophy. He's encouraged people to develop programs in mainstream academic centers. He's put together his own educational programs. They're now available online at integralinstitute.com, I think it is, or .org, I forget. And I think that, you know, Ken is one of those people who really is trying to live his life in a way that makes a contribution to the largest whole. I think that really being a voice of synthesis is something that is desperately needed at this time.
Well, if you have one thing you could say to the people of the world that you thought could or would make a difference, what would that be?
Well, I think consciousness is something that we have some control over. We can change our minds. We can change our perspectives. We can recognize that we story our experience. You know, like, how many times have I told that story about somebody who offended me or hurt me? Maybe I've told that story enough times now. Maybe it's time to let go of that story and think about something else, or think about that story in a new way with a different kind of ending. I think that those things that we can do something about, you know, are the things that we should work most at.
Well, thank you so much, Marilyn. I'm grateful that you were willing to come onto the show. And agape to you.
Agape to you, too. Thank you for your work.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.